Our final speaker is Stephen Schreiben, who is co-founder of the West Coast Environmental Law Association, and he has been involved in tracking the effects of free trade policy for the last two decades. Please welcome Stephen Schreiben.
Just one decade. I look a lot old. I'm only 26. I'd look a lot older if I'd actually been working on trade issues for two decades. So there are now two Michael Moores loose in the world. You know, you're Michael Moore, who in Canada we kind of think of as a little our Michael Moore because he's from Detroit, and they're Michael Moore, who used to be the, you know, used to be the Prime Minister of New Zealand. He's a kind of a wholehearted devotee of the ideology of free trade, and while he was Prime Minister, he embraced those policies with a vengeance. They were in many ways ruinous for his country, and yet after the people of New Zealand threw him and his party out of office, he remained unrepentant. And so I guess those were good job specs for becoming the head of the WTO. You know, he's written a lot about trade and spoken a lot about trade, and I don't have this firsthand. But a friend quotes him as saying something to the effect that, you know, free trade is a wonderful idea and the WTO is a wonderful institution, but it has to maybe become a little less determined to press its buttocks against the window of public opinion than it has been in offering up all of these disastrous decisions, striking down food safety laws in Europe and environmental and conservation laws here, and cultural policies and laws in Canada, and there are a number of other and a growing list of casualties of this international regime. But a friend of mine, having heard this, said, well, you know what we should call the meeting in Seattle is Moon Over Seattle. So remember, you heard that here first. It wasn't my idea, but this is free trade between Canada and the United States in ideas, in culture, the things that we should be sharing. Moon Over Seattle. So I'm going to talk to you about at least one big trade case, the gas reformulation case, and a few others as well. But I think before I do that, I'm just going to provide you with a little context. So many of you may be familiar with this already. But, you know, the WTO is a very, very new institution. I mean, it was created in January 1, 1995. I mean, a little over 4 years ago. And really what it represents is the culmination of a project that started after the Second World War with the Bretton Woods agreements that, as you know, also created the World Bank and the IMF and created the GATT. But the GATT kind of never had a home. It never had an institution with real authority to give it full effect. It took five decades to create that institution, nearly five decades, about 48 years. And that institution, as we know now, is the World Trade Organization. And it really represented a watershed in the evolution of the codification of the rules upon which globalization depend. And to understand it, you have to understand that it's representing more of a revolutionary than an evolutionary departure from anything that came before it. And that's true for two basic reasons. The first is that before the WTO, trade agreements were really about the trade of goods and commodities across international borders. After the WTO, what ostensibly is a trade regime, was about every aspect of contemporary social, economic, political, and cultural life. There simply isn't anything about domestic economic investment policy, intellectual property rules, regulations of every conceivable description, agricultural policy. By simply putting the prefix trade-related in front of investment measures or intellectual property, the TRIPS and the TRIMS agreement of the WTO has kind of neatly converted whole domains of domestic, economic, social, cultural policy into something that's a fit subject for trade regulation. I mean, it's preposterous. But there was a dramatic expansion of what it was feasible for a trade agreement to engender that happened with the WTO. That is very different than anything that preceded it. The other thing that was so radically different about the WTO was that it created truly enforceable trade decisions for the first time. Before the WTO, trade panels would make rulings, but they couldn't be enforced unless all of the members of the GATT agreed that they should be enforced, including the government against whom the order was made. So it kind of seems silly, because obviously you're not going to get enforcement unless the party somehow has agreed to abide by these international rules, and countries that were in a position to do so, as the United States often was, can simply thumb its nose at trade panels. But with the creation of the WTO, a ruling by the appellate body, which is the appeal court of the WTO, is automatically enforceable 60 days after it has been issued, unless every single member of the WTO agrees within that period of time to block it. So what required a consensus to implement now requires a consensus to defeat, including, of course, having to come to that agreement would be the country that won the dispute. And it all has to happen in 60 days. Well, I don't know why they bothered putting those provisions in the agreement, because those are conditions that are impossible to meet. And here are the consequences if you don't comply, okay? So, and they're kind of amply illustrated by the very first case to be decided by the WTO. And that had to do with Clean Air Act regulations in the United States having to do with the formulation or reformulation of gasoline products to remove contaminants that created NOx and VOx emissions when the fuel was burned. One of the ways in which the EPA has dealt with air quality issues in the United States is not only to require improvements in the efficiency of vehicles and require various polluters to implement pollution control systems, but has also been to clean up fuel, because cleaner fuel, when burnt, produces less pollutants. And so there was a fairly sophisticated regime established in the United States to accomplish that goal, which required gradual improvements from the industry over a baseline level of contamination in their products that was going to be established for the year 1990. It was kind of a response to the corporate community's complaints that if this was imposed upon them too quickly, the industry would collapse, or gasoline prices would rise precipitously, or there would be a great instability in both. And so the U.S. Government or the EPA administration decided, well, we'll do this gradually and we'll phase it in. And it was in the way those requirements were applied to foreign investors that provided them with a hook to use the WTO to challenge the gas reformulation rule. And there was a complaint, and there was a panel decision concluding that the U.S. laws were basically a barrier to trade and contaminated gasoline in this case and had to be removed. There was an appeal to the appellate body of the WTO, and the appeal came to the same conclusion, and the United States was put to its options. Either remove the offending regulation or pay these foreign refiners, I think in Brazil and Venezuela, tens of millions of dollars, I forget the figure, I think it was $60 or $70 million a year, for every year the regulations were maintained on the statute books in the United States. Well, I mean, you understand that that's not a price that even the wealthiest nation in the world can pay to preserve its environmental measures. And that's the kind of coercive authority that we've now allowed this new global institution. Now, there are lots of other cases, and there are cases involving challenges by Time Warner to Canadian policies, and they're all successful, that would have preserved some capacity for Canadian magazine publishers and periodicals to kind of maintain some market share in Canada. This is probably an issue that's too, I don't know if it's too esoteric to get into, but let me just try quickly. U.S. magazines sell split runs in Canada. So it's U.S. magazine, Sports Illustrated. There's a couple pages added of Canadian content, and then they offer advertising space in the magazine at half the price that it's offered in the original publication in the United States. Well, imagine if you're a Canadian magazine trying to compete when you have to pay the full cost of producing a magazine for a Canadian market. That's what was the issue. And the WTO ruled against Canada, notwithstanding Canadian protests to Canadian voters for years that culture wasn't vulnerable to trade complaints. And when Canada wasn't quick enough to implement kind of removing the offending measures that protected some small preserve for Canadian culture, it isn't as if Canada isn't awash in U.S. culture and U.S. magazines. It's only whether or not we would be able to maintain any space for Canadians to hear their own voices. The U.S. threatened $300 million a year worth of retaliatory trade sanctions. Strategically identifying the specific sectors against which the countervailing measures would be imposed. So, for example, there were going to be large countervailing tariffs imposed on steel exports from the riding of the Minister of Culture in Canada. It was a very kind of strategic exercise, and Canada quickly buckled. Canada is not only a victim of this regime, it's also a perpetrator. It's challenging a ban by the government of France on asbestos, a ban on asbestos. It joined with the United States in challenging European food safety measures. It's probably a mistake to think of these disputes as being parochial, as between nations. Ultimately, they're disputes between large corporations and the ambition of certain countries still to regulate corporate activity in the public interest. And so to understand, I mean, the basic premise of this regime, it's simply that, it's privatization, deregulation, and free trade is the clarion call of the right, at least in Canada. I don't know whether those are the same terms that are used here. Deregulation is simply you can't regulate corporations in the public interest anymore. Privatization means you can't regulate our access to business in your community, whether that's providing municipal services or, in Canada, healthcare, which is still provided by the community, for the community, on a universal basis, to education services or to any other way in which we want to make business. You can't concern yourself about the way we produce our products, whether we harvest them in unsustainable ways, whether we pay workers nothing to work in our sweatshops. That's not your business. You're not to regulate under any conditions or in any circumstances. We want access to your markets and your resources on our terms and without any interference. I mean, that's basically the gist of the agenda, and these very, very powerful enforcement mechanisms make it very clear to all governments that they must comply, and that even resisting not only will it be futile, but it will be painful and embarrassing because they may have to abandon in a very public way measures that still benefit from a great deal of public support because they're measures to protect the environment, to conserve resources, or to protect public health. So the cases are a godsend, really. I mean, as odious as they are, because they illustrate the kind of sharp contradictions that exist between, any reasonable notion of environmental protection or consumer protection and these international rules. And if we didn't have the cases, it would be much harder to persuade people that the WTO was a problematic institution and that the rules that it had put in place were fundamentally at odds with the notions of democratic process or sustainable development. But really, the stuff that you don't see is much worse than the stuff that you do see. The influence of this regime is pernicious, and it's ubiquitous, and it's very invasive and corrosive of democratic process and civil societies everywhere. And the stuff that is most problematic is really not the stuff that has to do with environmental standards or public measures, but has to do with economic and kind of trade policy in the most structural way. So the stuff that's so destructive in terms of agriculture and the World Trade Organization really doesn't have much to do with food safety standards. It has to do with the globalization of an industrial model of agricultural production that will reduce every part of the world to a specialized producer of a commodity for an international market. Farmers no longer produce food for consumers or local markets. They produce commodities for international markets. It's a disaster, of course, for a farmer who happened to live in a cooperative farm in Mexico in Ejido who's lost his capacity to feed himself and his family, however subsistence that living might have been, because now the programs that Mexico had in place to support cooperative farming in Ejidos have been dismantled, and you can describe the same scenario in many and probably every other social and cultural context. But it's also a disaster in terms of the ecology of food systems. We are embracing a model of agricultural production which will dramatically increase its energy intensity. And if you include all of the energy demands and greenhouse gas emissions associated with global food systems, it turns out to be the largest user and the largest source. And much of that energy has to do with packaging, processing, and distributing agricultural commodities. And by embracing this model, which requires everything to move enormous distances, be packaged to survive the journey, be processed to survive the journey, we're dramatically increasing the energy demands of what is the world's largest business. Most climate change campaigners won't think about agriculture that way because they won't be thinking about food systems. They'll just be thinking about on-the-farm inputs. At that very moment when it's overwhelmingly clear that we have to reduce our use of energy, that we have to dramatically cut back greenhouse gas emissions. And it's that kind of structural relationship, you know, that will be so difficult to undo. When you remove whole communities and societies from the land, when you put in place the infrastructure necessary to support these global systems. I mean, what's in those trucks on those highways, you know? What is that industrial process heat being used for, you know? Half of all packaging is consumer packaging is food packaging. What's all that packaging about? What's all that garbage in the landfill site about? It's a very structural system that we're putting in place. It will endure, you know, for decades after it is created. And I can describe the same scenario for forest resources, for fishery resources, for energy resources, for culture. You know? In many ways, this globalization paradigm is the enemy of diversity. You know, this notion of comparative advantage is the notion of specialize. Do what you do best. You know, do only what you do best. And it's a complete lie in a world of absolutely mobile capital. So that, you know, anybody can be forced to do anything, kind of anywhere, particularly if they're desperate enough. But it's really kind of the enemy of the whole concept of diversity. You know, whether it's biodiversity, you know, whether it's biodiversity, economic diversity, cultural diversity, I mean, globalization's answer is kind of one big thing, one big corporation. So how did it happen? I mean, how could this have happened? Well, it happened by stealth. You know, it happened by kind of neglect in a way. I mean, you know, the WTO took 5 decades to create. The Uruguay round negotiations that actually created this thing started in 86. It was the same year that free trade negotiations started between Canada and the United States. You had a bunch of technocrats in government who dealt with trade issues, and everybody thought international trade was a pretty esoteric, arcane subject, including everybody within government other than in a trade ministry or a trade department or an economic ministry or an economic department, so they weren't paying a lot of attention. You know, the people who are responsible for health care or municipal services or the environment or culture weren't paying a lot of attention to what the trade technocrats were up to. Nobody had any idea how expansive their ambition had become. You had corporations that had become global and began to think of the whole didn't like regulations to begin with, in the imperative to maximize profits. Any degree of government control is offensive and problematic because it reduces profits. But in the new global paradigm, any notion of local control doesn't make any sense anymore. I mean, you don't do things locally anymore. You don't produce in a particular place for a particular place. You produce everywhere. You put pieces together from everywhere. And you produce for everywhere. So the whole notion of, even if you were willing to accept because you care about the environment and you don't want to spoil the planet, that you might need some level of environmental regulation, the notion of any kind of local control, which is fundamentally problematic. And this was kind of, and these were global enterprises that were fully integrated, involved every, you know, I mean, these were huge mega corporations, and so suddenly intellectual property and standards and investment measures and services, it all made sense to bring it in, because after all, this was the way the world was working. And so, secretly, behind closed doors, with nobody paying attention, with civil society being rebuffed the odd time they showed up and knocked to see what was going on in that room back there, with other people in government ostensibly there, elected by us to represent our interests, paying no attention, this thing was created. Yeah. And some of us who warned about it back then were dismissed. You know, well, it's not that serious. They don't know what they're talking about. There's a lot of overblown anxiety. Don't worry about it. Everything is going to be wonderful after this thing is accomplished. And here we are, you know, 4 years later. And still the structural stuff remains obscure, but these cases have made it clear to people in Europe that, you know, people in Europe are saying, well, why should the WTO be telling us what we have to eat, you know? And people in the Minister of the Environment in England, I read a quote from him the other day, well, why is the WTO telling us that we can't help the economies of some poor Caribbean nations? I mean, what is this? What is this thing? You know, and it's taken 3 or 4 years for kind of the light to start to go on for a lot of folks. And so this meeting here, this is, you know, the WTO, by the way, is ostensibly governed by its ministers when they meet. And they meet every 2 years. So this is only the second meeting since this monstrous regime was created. And the first one was in Singapore, which was inaccessible, and there wasn't a lot of experience with the WTO, and, you know, public protest wasn't all that feasible. And this is going to be the second. And there are 250 or 300 people here on Sunday night. So this is very encouraging for me. And for all of you, I hope. You know, a Canadian, am I running out of time? Now, you know, now that this thing is kind of, now that it's kind of poked its head up, as Michael Moore says, is pressing its buttocks against the window of public opinion, you know, our job is really, because, I mean, the stealth strategy is really, you know, their single best strategy. You know, if nobody knows about this, then they're laughing. And this will largely operate at a very subterranean level. We won't know when governments decide not to regulate because they don't want the embarrassment of a WTO challenge, and that's what the lawyer representing the company letter just told them they were facing if they actually proceeded. And there's lots of evidence of that in Canada. I don't know about the examples in the U.S., but we backed off of plain labeling legislation for cigarette packages. We backed away from licensing generic drugs to reduce the cost of public health care in Canada. We backed away from, as you know, the banning of MMT in gasoline. That was a NAFTA case, but those are precisely the rules, the MAI rules they want in the WTO. Stuff just simply gets taken off the table when nobody's present, and we don't know what happened to it, or why these days, as environmentalists, we're fighting defensive struggles to maintain what the gains we've accomplished in the last 25 years, rather than at that very moment when, you know, the imperatives have never been clearer around biodiversity loss and climate change and absolutely pressing ecological problems. We're fighting defensive struggles. We're on our heels, you know, rather than kind of forging ahead. So we've got to drag this thing out into the light of day, you know? It can only survive in the shadows. It will be defeated by democratic process and debate, precisely the democratic process and debate that it would expunge. Now, so if we're going to do it, do I have any advice for you or for myself? I think it's this. It's, you know, refuse to be psyched out. You know, it kind of, it's like kind of a tennis match or any kind of contest. You know, I mean, now that debates become public, their strategy is to psych us out. You can't, you know, they will dismiss us in the media. But I really encourage people to. I've written a book. It's another Citizen's Guide to WTO. I know there's one in the States, which tries to reduce. It'll be out this week. This regime to terms that people can understand. You have to become a little trade literate. It's now the price of admission. This regime is so pervasive in its influence over public policy that you have to know a little bit about trade in order to engage in that public debate. And it's not hard to refuse to be bamboozled, you know, by the language, by the jargon, you know. It's about the food you eat, you know. It's about the air you breathe, you know. It's about economic justice. It's about very fundamental things that people understand. And so you have to resist the temptation to be mystified by it all. I have. But also, don't get psyched out. I mean, their line with us is, well, you know, it's inevitable. There is no alternative. You know, you can't defeat us. We're going to win. Don't embarrass yourself by even trying. Well, you know what? They're rattled. They're shaken. The defeat of the MAI was an enormous defeat for them, as were the fast-track victories in the States. There's a very famous Canadian environmentalist and feminist whose name is Ursula Franklin. She says, you know, when I used to speak to people in power, I used to always assume they were well-intentioned but ill-informed, you know? These days, I kind of assume they're well-informed and ill-intentioned. But ultimately, it doesn't matter. You know, I don't think this is some diabolical conspiracy to defeat democratic society. Some of you may disagree with me. I think it's the inevitable consequence of this mindless pursuit of growth, you know, and consumption. But it really doesn't matter at the end of the day whether we're defeated because somebody's planned it or because we stumbled into it. We have to resist this regime. We will not survive it if it endures. I think that this meeting this fall will be the pivotal moment. We will look back on it and appreciate that this was the moment, that the tide turned, that we actually turned this machine around. In favor of creating international agreements that were created to deal with the problems we do need to deal with. International trade agreements, the objectives of which were to provide people with food security, were to reduce global warming, were to preserve cultural and biodiversity, were to support democratic institutions and social justice. This November will be that moment. Thanks a lot.
We invite you to join with other concerned members of civil society in their demonstrations against the World Trade Organization in Seattle from November 29th to December 3rd. People from all across America and around the world are coming to Seattle to oppose the anti-democratic WTO during its secret closed-door trade negotiations. For more information on the demonstrations, talks, and workshops held by civil society during the WTO negotiations, please call 1-877-STOP-WTO or visit the websites www.peopleforfairtrade.org and www.seattlewto.org.